The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. And welcome to round four of the FA Cup, Kieran.
Yes, we both went a goal down against Championship clubs and came back to win 2-1. So an away day in the FA Cup is memorable, and I've got to say we had a fantastic day out in West Brom, because there's a pub near the ground called The Vine, and it does the greatest kebabs and chicken tikkas on the planet. And everybody piles in there before the match, we then go and watch the football, which, as you know, football day is a great day out with your mates, normally spoiled by 90 minutes of football, but happy with the result.
Well, you've got some extra minutes of football for your money, and at least your day out was memorable. At least your day out was memorable for good reasons, other than I went to bed last night with the sound of police dogs barking in my ears.
It was like
stepping out of a TARDIS. You think Doctor Who's taking me back to 1979? This is not pleasant. Should we do this, Kieran?
Yes, let's.
Let's do this. Yes, enough of the pleasant chit chat about away days, and let's hope we don't get each other in the draw for the cup. I'm already nervous about Friday. It's only Monday morning now, and I'm nervous about Friday night. It's Questions Day, Kieran, but we do have a couple of big stories. One of them potentially very big, and you'd think good news, but some people not entirely delighted. But Mike Ashley, it seems, is genuinely interested in buying Derby County.
Yes, and this rumour has been swirling round for a few weeks. We've spoken to some of our friends who are a bit closer to the story than the likes of themselves, and they've confirmed that yes, it's definitely has some legs. What we've seen at Derby is the administrators before Christmas said they were going to announce a preferred bidder imminently. Well, it's now the 10th of January. Now that to me is not imminently from pre-Christmas. There were, I think, two parties. One was a guy called Chris Kirchner, who seemed to be a bit of a Donald Trump fanboy, who was conducting his negotiations partly through social media, which I don't think is a very sensible way to do it. It does smack of Eric Alonso Mark II. he pulled out. There's been a lot of talk also about a deal headed by a guy called Andy Appleby, who used to be the chairman of the club, and that would involve him with Sam Rush, who's the former chief executive, who was then sacked for gross misconduct at Derby and reached some form of settlement. He's also involved historically with an agency called Wasserman. And for people that listen to the show regularly, I believe he was the chief executive at the time of the legendary paying a certain player's mother £700,000 to be an academy scout. So I think that might have been linked to some of his falling out with Mel Morris.
Tom Ince, we can say it, Kieran. Tom Ince.
Tom Ince. Okay.
I mean, it was us that put it in the public domain, so I think we're entitled to keep telling, reminding people who the player was and who the mother was. But certainly Sky Sports seem to think that the Mike Ashley story is is a genuine one. They're reporting a figure of between 50 and 60 million pounds. Does that sound right?
It does. I've heard that Mike Ashley is striking a really hard bargain, so it's likely to be at the lower of that particular range. And if he does get the club for 50 million, I think the problem there is going to be is that under EFL rules, you have to pay all of the football creditors in full. You then have to pay all of what's referred to as the preferential creditors in full. So that will be any people of outstanding loans, which is secured as mortgages. So that can be linked to MSD Holdings. And also HMRC. Now, it looks as if the administrators are trying to negotiate some form of haircut with HMRC to say, well, if the club goes into liquidation, you're only going to get 30%, so we'll offer you 50 or 60, and that will give them a bit more leeway. I suspect HMRC will be encouraged to take a harsh view on this because they will feel that if they set a precedent for giving a football club a discount on what's owed, and ultimately, remember, this money is owed by the taxpayer. This money was collected from football players and was collected from all of the employees of Derby County Football Club by Mel Morris, by the people he, and that money was then not paid across to the taxpayer. So, I think it's a very sensitive issue. And you also have to pay all of the unsecured creditors, the people that supplied Mel Morris's Derby County in good faith for goods and services. And certainly my experience of dealing with insolvency work, but also dealing with football work, is that a lot of local creditors will have given the club a bit of extra leeway because, hey, you know, it's Derby, it's Mel, we love the club ourselves. So, you know, when normally perhaps they would have asked the solicitor to have chased the money a lot earlier when it was outstanding, they didn't do so because they didn't want to put pressure on the club. So, if those people are not paid, and they've got to be paid at least 25% under EFL rules, then there is a further 15-point penalty. Now, could the EFL waive that? Potentially they could, but I think they would be under huge pressure from other clubs to not do that, given that historically other clubs who have come out of administration, the people who have bought them, and we take the case of Bolton Wanderers, for example, their new owners have had to work really hard to pay off the unsecured creditors their 25%. They'll turn around and say, well, you know, we've worked our arse off to do this. Why is Mike Ashley, who, let's be honest, is a very wealthy man, why is he not having to do this? So it could be that Mike Ashley might take the view that if he's looking at Derby County, and Mike Ashley's a very smart businessman. I know he's unpopular in Newcastle. We fully understand the reasons why. He's equally unpopular in half of Glasgow because of things that he's done in respect of Rangers. But he knows how to lowball in terms of prices. He might see the 15-point penalty as something being worth taking because if it saves him X million pounds and it puts back Derby County 1 year in terms of his long-term plans for the club, he might feel that that's a price worth paying.
You don't think by the tone of your voice that there's any possibility that if Mike Ashley bought Derby County, he would just pay off the unsecured creditors? I mean, bearing in mind he's got a spare 360 million quid odd from Newcastle, would it not make any sense at all for him to just pay the 5 million, 6 million pounds it's going to take?
It could be. I mean, he might, because the financial benefit of, if Derby County are in the Championship, the difference between League One and the Championship in terms of TV money is worth 5 or 6 million. So to a certain extent, it's as broad as it's long. But and there's, you know, he will have worked out the sums. It makes far more sense for Derby County to be in the Championship, you know, and we have to acknowledge there's a pretty high chance of them getting relegated this season. But what they don't want is an additional season in League One, because they have to go and pay a 15-point penalty. Yeah. But also, League One is an absolute beast of a division. now, because you've got Sunderland there, Portsmouth, Ipswich, Charlton, Sheffield Wednesday. There's a lot of big, big clubs in that division. So if people think it's just a 12-month holiday in League One, a chance to increase the number of grounds we've visited as away fans, don't do that. Yeah, just think how long Sunderland have been there.
And Kieran, regardless of Mike Ashley's unpopularity at Newcastle, and we know how he goes about his business, surely this is good news for Derby fans, though, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting that there are one or two already saying, I'd rather not be saved by Mike Ashley, but you want the club saved and secure, don't you? Whether it's by somebody like Mike Ashley or Mother Teresa, which is unlikely for several reasons, but you know what I mean?
Yes, because the other alternative is liquidation.
Well, exactly so. And you know in Mike Ashley, he's a man who has the money to save the club and to keep the club going, and we'll keep it. He might not spend money on the ground, but he'll keep the club chugging along until such time as he can make a profit on it. That's got to be a good thing, isn't it?
I think that is the case. I mean, he made money out of Newcastle. He has made money out of many of his other businesses. He knows a distressed asset when he sees one. He can see the potential in Derby County. You won't be getting marquee signings, but certainly I would say I've been sort of monitoring this on social media. The vast majority of Derby County fans are taking a pragmatic view.
Of course.
After 3 or 4 years of Mel Morris, who decided to gamble with the future of the club, and when he lost that gamble, he didn't do the decent thing. He walked away. I don't think Mike Ashley will do that. I mean, for all of his unpopularity at Newcastle, he lent the club £111 million interest-free, and he made sure that the bills were paid. Now, as you said, he spent absolutely nothing on the infrastructure of the club. Fans were getting fed up in terms of the recruitment policy, but they were still in the Premier League, and they actually became very attractive to a new owner because they inherited a club that had huge leeway in terms of what it could then spend in terms of new players coming in, because they were such a strong position from an FFP perspective.
Yeah, now I think this other news story is good news, Kieran, but we've learned from experience that there are a couple of splinter groups in Bury. It's all very Life of Brian at the moment up there, who may not think it's good news. But the Bury supporters group, EST 1885, say they've bought Gig Lane and the club's name.
Yes. I think, my view, this is fantastic news.
Good.
Because I think it's partly there's some money come from a levelling up fund. There is an individual benefactor. We're aware of who it is. We're not going to say who it is. We don't think that's right and proper. The most important thing is contracts have been exchanged, is our understanding. Also, the Club 1885 people, they've been given a license which will allow them to start cleaning up Gig Lane. So they're starting to look for volunteers on a weekend basis and so on. Right. And hey, folks, if you want to do something good for Bury Football Club or the future of Bury and football, go along and lend a hand. You'll be amongst good people. So it looks as if the stadium has been sold, the name has been sold, the memorabilia have been sold. Where this leaves the Phoenix Club, Splinter Club, whatever you want to call it, AFC, They're presently playing at tier 10 of football. They're getting amazing crowds. They're taking 800 or 900 to away games. Again, hats off to them. I think whilst there are some people who are taking a very, very harsh stance in terms of one for the other, I think probably at a more senior level, we will see a degree of pragmatism from both parties. Realistically, Bury would struggle to support two clubs. It's a town of limited size. It's surrounded by some pretty monstrous clubs, I think it's in the long term interest. So I suspect there will be a few olive branches a few olive branches extended. People will start to get together, and whatever is in the best long-term interest. So yeah, we don't know what the Newbury Football Club will be able to do in terms of it will be applying to play in certain leagues. If that's at a higher tier than AFC Bury, it could be that they move in together, or if it's at a lower tier, then effectively AFC Bury or Bury AFC move in themselves. So yeah, I think it's really good news. I'm delighted for those people. So yeah, I went to the town hall meetings at Bury, and it was one of it was from an outsider's point of view, it was just so distressing. It was like watching a funeral of somebody that you didn't know, and people were in a great state of shock at the time.
Yeah, to coin a phrase that you only taught me on the last pod, ITK. you say that we are ITK about this individual benefactor. I am not ITK, so you'll have to tell me who that is off air.
Right.
And I believe is there a report from the administrators at Bury? Is that right?
Yes. So this is Stephen Wiseglass, who was appointed, I think I've been a bit circumspect about him historically, given his record. But he seems to have done a certainly on the basis of his report, it seems to be thorough. There's a few unusual things that he's reported. It looks as if Bury have creditors of around about £12.5 million. I've got to be honest, the chances of them getting any money are between they're slim and zero and slim's out of town. It's one of those situations. But reading his report, there were a couple of things which caused eyebrows, and I'll hold on to yours here, Kevin, eyebrows to be raised. So it said in the last few games of Bury taking place at Gig Lane, some reason the club appeared to move to a cash-only approach for gate receipts. And I think he's in his words, he's investigating further as to why that happened. And also, when he's tried to establish, you know, if you are administrator, the day that you're appointed, you take control of all of that limited company's assets. And I certainly know from my own experience of doing this, you know, that's quite a challenging job. He said that a certain number of assets appeared to have been, and in I quote, uplifted from the training ground.
Oh, now,
who's uplifted them? Why they were uplifted? How they were uplifted? We don't know.
Uncle Terry's not been in the Bury area recently, is he?
Well, it sounds straight from the Uncle Terry management model, management manual. So, yes, we don't know who's done this, so we're not going to point any fingers. We're not that type of people. That would be cynical of us.
No, but you have clearly implied by the tone of your voice who we think it is. But the cash turnstile thing is interesting. One of the more enjoyable parts is, so when we're on the train, obviously train packed with Palace fans going up to South Bermondsey, and there was a bloke explaining to his young son, he said, no, in the old days, you just went to the turnstile, you gave the bloke a fiver, and he let you in. And this kid couldn't get his head around the idea that you just paid cash. You just turned up. Didn't have to download anything or go to a website, but you just turned up and you gave the bloke a fiver.
Or you gave him £6 and you and two of your mates went in.
Exactly, yeah, especially if you knew him. So let's get on to the questions, Kieran. We have some very good questions today. Two in particular that got me thinking quite a lot, actually, which with my attention span is a remarkable feat. The first question is from Will Grieve. And Will says, once a release clause is met by the buying club, are the selling club able to negotiate any additional clauses, such as a sell-on fee, or are they unable to do so if a release clause has already been activated?
It would depend upon the nature of the wording in the release clause itself. The release clause normally allows, if a suitable offer comes in, for the two parties, i.e. the player and the buying club, to formally talk to each other. Now, we know from talking to agents is that the buying club and the player will already have talked to each other, or, you know, because what's the point in putting in a bid for a player if he's or she's completely settled where they are? So that would normally allow the formalities to go through. I think it actually would be quite difficult for a selling club to negotiate additional clauses, because otherwise, yeah, let's say that there's a player who you don't want to let go. He's got a release clause of £30 million in his contract. If you then say, well, after he plays five games for the next club, you've got to pay us another £30 million, it effectively scuppers the deal. So on that basis, and you know, I think I'm sure some of the agents that listen to the show will correct us if we're wrong. I would say that the release clause really puts all of the eggs in the basket into that one particular fee. It could be that you might be able to negotiate extra amounts for not necessarily playing matches, but for it could be an add-on if the player is sold on, that's a little bit feasible. If they win trophies, that is feasible, but I think it would be quite challenging, because you've already committed yourself to say to the player, if you sign this contract, we will pay you X thousand pounds per week, and we will allow you to leave if somebody pays us £30 million for your registration, not £30 million plus an extra £10 million for this, an extra £10 million for that, and so on. Because from the player's point of view, especially if he's a very good player, if the buying club get him for a relatively low fee, then his agent will be aware of that and will try to put that into wage negotiations.
Our next question, Kieran, comes from James Brooks, and it introduced a concept that I found really interesting, and I think it's a really good question. And James says, football is currently treated as a business subject to the free market, like any other business, with limited financial regulation. However, the market differs significantly from others in that brand loyalty is so exclusive, it prevents supporters or customers, in inverted commas, moving between clubs. If one supermarket puts up their prices, I go to another. If my club Chesterfield put up prices, I can't go down the road and watch Mansfield Town. And he has put asterisks instead of letters for most of Mansfield Town, which I applaud. Surely there's a case for financial regulation of football on the grounds that the market is distorted by the extreme brand loyalty of its customers. And while we're talking about Chesterfield, Kieran, that was one of the highlights of the FA Cup weekend, seeing their 5,000 fans at Chelsea going absolutely crazy when they scored a goal right at the end. That was proper FA Cup experience. But this is something it's just not occurred to me before, but James is absolutely right. You've got almost 100% brand loyalty. So does that make a case for financial regulation?
It certainly does, and this is one of the effective conclusions reached by Tracy Crouch's report, in that football is unique. In theory, you have a choice of a dozen clubs to go and watch each week in London.
Yeah,
but there's only one you're ever going to support. There's only one I'm ever going to. I lived in Manchester for 40 years of my life. In the eyes of most people, I'm a complete idiot for supporting Brighton for doing that. All that period. But for me, when talking to a football fan, they fully understand.
Of course.
A bank or a phone operator, they would give their eye teeth for our brand loyalty to that particular product. It's not given in practically anything else. Even if you like a pint, or if you smoke or something, you would change brands if somebody came in and offered a discount on what you're presently paying. But there's, if somebody offered you a free season ticket at Millwall or Charlton or Brighton, you just completely blank them, and rightly so. It's a non-issue. So on the basis of that, because we are effectively – football is the nearest thing to religion in the 21st century we are a secular society. It does need some form of protection and some form of regulation, in my opinion, and in the opinion of Tracy Crouch, who wrote the report, and the vast majority of the people that she spoke to, who were, of course, from football club supporters themselves. In an ideal world, we would have owners who we could trust, and we would have regulation that we could trust from the industry itself. But It simply hasn't been the case in the way that things have worked out, and that's where we are today. So yeah, I'm completely in alignment with James here that self-regulation's like self-abuse. It makes you very short-sighted, and that's what we've seen from the football industry over the course of the last few years, and therefore it needs somebody to take control of the industry.
That's a good Catholic boy speaking there, isn't it? The reason we wear glasses, Kieran, is because we're middle-aged men. It's nothing to do with anything else. I think, you know what, the only other brand loyalty I could think of that compares is pretty much pubs. If somebody said to us, why don't we meet in another pub other than the Porson's Arms before a Palace game, we would all just look at them and go, why would we do that? And they don't quite exploit us as much as football clubs do, but they're close sometimes.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This next question comes from Villa Lagerstedt. Apologies if I've mangled that pronunciation. And it's about a topic that we have talked about a lot, but this historical context, I think, makes it an interesting question. As Villa says, he listened to an interview with Sven-Göran Eriksson recently, and he talked about his time at Notts County, which, again, that's a question you'd get wrong and pointless, isn't it? And Villa says that Sven said he received an offer and a challenge that he couldn't refuse by two gentlemen. And these two gentlemen said they would invest as much as was required to bring the club up to the Premier League. Now, as we know, things didn't go to plan, and they did not. Has there been any development since then when it comes to background checks done on new owners or investors? And how do these new checks work exactly? I think the answer is probably there hasn't been that much progress, has there?
I think there has been a degree of progress because for people not familiar with the story, Notts County were acquired in 2009 by a company called Munto Finance. And this was shortly after the takeover of Manchester City. So at the time, Notts County were in the lower leagues. And having seen all of the money that went into Manchester City, there was a degree of giddiness, I think it's fair to say, amongst Notts County fans. The club at the time was owned by the Supporters Trust. I think they perhaps didn't do as much due diligence as perhaps they could have done. But given the circumstances, you do take people in terms of good faith. I think there is an assumption amongst practically every football fan that anybody from the Middle East is a billionaire.
Yeah.
That simply isn't the case. And then once you started to dig into Munto Finance a little bit more deeply, you found that it was a Swiss-owned company called Quadbank that was involved. That was based in the British Virgin Islands. As soon as I see BVI, Cayman Islands, Isle of Man, whatever it's going to be, these type of places, I start to get a little bit twitchy. There are some good companies there, but why, if you're going to be based in Nottingham, why are you going to be why do you have to go and do your operations out of BVI? And I think one of the guys involved in theory was a guy called Anwar Shafi. And he went, or rather, he was quoted on the Notts County website saying, we've got amazing plans for Notts County. This is what we're going to do. We're going to bring in, they sacked the manager. They brought in Sven-Goran Eriksson. They brought in Sol Campbell as a player. I think his contract was cancelled by mutual agreement after a few matches. Mm. I think the politest thing we can say is he didn't acclimatise to League Two. and League Two didn't acclimatise to him. And in terms of this guy called Anwar Shafi, who I think is quite a wealthy individual, he then popped up and said, these comments on the club website, these have not been made by me. I don't know where they've come from. This is not true. And then things started to unravel, and very quickly it turned out that it looks like these new owners, for want of a better word, they quickly managed to rack up around about £7 million worth of debt. There were some mysterious payments of around about £200,000 to people in Bahrain, which have never really got to the bottom of. Perhaps they've been used to buy some of the memorabilia of Bury Football Club, for all we know. I think it was issues of this nature which led to the what we now have as the owners and directors test, and those rules have gradually become more beefed up. So now there is we've always said that there's two types of checks. First of all, is there any evidence of unspent criminal convictions in relation to the people involved? And secondly, what the football authorities are now demanding is, we want to see evidence that you have the resources to fund the club. Now, those were not in place in 2009. Could those background checks be more onerous? I think they could be, but you would need football clubs themselves to vote through the changes. And turkeys don't vote for Christmas. You know, what if I was the owner of a football club, and remember, we've just seen Southampton be sold, why make it more difficult for me to sell the football club to somebody else? Because if I'm trying to get it off my hands, I just want the money. And to a large extent, I'm not overly fussed as to who buy it. I don't want it to go to somebody bad, but that's not going to be my problem in the future. So the rules have been beefed up. Could they be beefed up further? Yes, they could, but I don't think there's any appetite for that from club owners.
Our next question, Kieran, I think is the perfect price of football question, because it starts with a very intelligent question and ends with a crazy conspiracy theory. It's perfect. That's always going to get asked. If you're wondering why your question's not been asked, tag on a crazy conspiracy theory and will undoubtedly get asked, or make it about football kits from the 1970s. That will always be asked. But it comes from Henry Bishop, and it is a very interesting question. Henry Bishop says, in the Euros, 8 of the 15 knockout matches went to extra time, with 4 of those matches going to penalties. Other games like Dinamo Zagreb v Tottenham and the Man United-Villarreal final in this season's Europa League also went beyond the 90 minutes. Now, did the sponsors, whose adverts were shown more times during these matches, pay any more money? And if yes, when does this get paid? If no, then would UEFA, FIFA, etc. want more games in their tournaments to go to extra time to let sponsors have more advertising for the same amount of money? And will this have had anything to do with UEFA abolishing the away goals rule in club competitions? So
superb.
Did UEFA abolish the away goals rule so sponsors weren't getting more value for money? But the first part, it's a very interesting question, because the sponsors are getting possibly 45 minutes more advertising time, aren't they?
They are. What does happen is that sponsors do pay bonuses for progress in terms of competitions, and that progress is actually linked to, do we qualify for the semi-finals, the finals, win the competition, and so on. In terms of the additional broadcasting time, The broadcasters do not pay additional fees to UEFA and FIFA. They negotiate a set fee in advance. Now, they know from history that, you know, on average, 30% of games will go into extra time, 15% of games will go to penalties, and FIFA and UEFA know that too. So in some competitions, it will go above the expected, you know, expected. You know, we've got XG for goals. Well, we've got, you know, XXT for expected extra time as well, and that would have been factored into the negotiations at the times when the two parties got together. So there will not be additional money paid just because, you know, two semi-finals and a final go into extra time and penalties. That's just a bonus for the broadcasters, yeah, because, you know, clearly they've got more adverts that they can now fill in. Although they would argue that, you know, if I'm ITV and I'm broadcasting a World Cup match, we're still going to show the news at 10 o'clock. What we're not going to do is we'll have 5 minutes of Roy Keane and Ian Wright discussing the match instead of 45. But yeah, we were still planning to run adverts. So they said we might get a bit of extra money, but we're not actually going to get a lot because people are already paid for those slots. So I don't see any additional money coming in. And again, the front of shirt sponsors for the UEFA competitions, by the UEFA competitions, we're talking Champions League, Conference, Europa League and so on, those fees will have been agreed in advance. Extra time wouldn't have been factored in. In terms of Henry's fantastic question, trying to link it to the abolishment of the away goals rule, that's actually come from FIFA and especially UEFA's technical committees. They realise that the style of play being played these days, if you go back historically, why was the away goals rule initially introduced? It was because in the first leg of matches, clubs were just turning up and parking the bus. And it wasn't actually very attractive. You know, you were 10 men behind the ball from the first minute. You try to get a nil-nil and then take them back to your place. What we now see is that home clubs actually see a nil-nil home draw in the first leg. They actually quite like that because they know that they only had to score one goal in the second leg. So therefore, FIFA, UEFA say that we're going to abolish that because we want to see more attacking football.
Dan Jones is a man I have taken a liking to. I don't know Dan, but I like him. He's a good man. Dan, you're a good man. Dan's question is, on Crawley's, otherwise known as Sussex's Premier Club, that's harder to say than I thought, otherwise known as Sussex's Premier Club. Yes, Crawley, as Dan says, Sussex's Premier Club. On their latest set of accounts, we made a modest profit, but this appeared to be due to debts being written off. In the long term, is it better for the financial health of the club to post profits due to written off debts or losses without? I like Crawley. I had a really, really good night out there a couple of years ago when my cousin was playing for Whitehawk and they played Crawley in the Sussex Senior Cup. We had a lovely evening. It was very nice, very friendly, nice bar. But anyway, it's a good question, Kieran.
Yeah, have you seen the Sussex match, which has gone viral, where they the five red cards and
no?
I'll link. If anybody's not seen this on YouTube, this is proper park football.
Oh, great.
At sort of semi pro level, and so some of the tackles you go, Jesus Christ, what are they trying to do? It was, yeah, it was people was clear. I think scores were being settled in a way that Uncle Terry would approve of.
Anyway, let's remind ourselves of Dan's question. Is it better for the financial health of Crawley to post profits due to written off debts or losses without?
Right. From a pure financial point of view, it doesn't make a blind bit of difference because if you write off a debt, it has no impact on cash. And if the debt is unpaid, you don't receive the cash. So from a pure financial position. But if perhaps you're trying to get a message across and you're willing to write off the losses, especially if the owner is thinking of selling the club at some point, then it might look a little bit better. Crawley made a profit of £473,000 in 2020. And that was partly affected by COVID. So people are going, well, that's quite an achievement. It does appear that the club had quite a lot of debt, some of which disappeared. And the you know, we've discussed before, banks don't lend to football clubs. It's owners who lend to football clubs. Mm-hmm. And it looks as if the owner, who is a guy called Ziya Erin, a Turkish guy, I think he has written off some debts. And I think in an ideal world, his period of ownership has not delivered what he was expecting. So perhaps he's looking to move on. So it's one of those things. It's, you know, six of one and a half, a dozen of the other.
I like the sound of our next questioner as well, Kieran. I like him. He's a nice fellow. Callum Day. Question from Callum Day, who says, what sort of revenue would Spurs have received from the Joshua Usyk fight in September? Is it purely a rental of the stadium, or will Spurs get a rental plus profit share? Similarly, at Leicester, we had a music gig for Kasabian. Leicester fans, I don't know if they've ever mentioned it, Kieran, but they are Leicester fans, apparently.
They do mention it just every single interview.
Yes, I had half a night out with Kasabian once. They're good mates with Noel Fielding. I didn't know they were Kasabian at the time, was the only problem. Right. It's only afterwards that I learned those pleasant, hairy young men were actually in a musical group called Kasabian. but anyway, similarly at Leicester, they had a music gig for Kasabian over a few nights at the KP Stadium. But this was the only out-of-football event held in that capacity. Is it commercially worth it to hold such events? No, I mean, I think it was part of Tottenham's business plan, wasn't it, Kieran, that the stadium would be usable every night, if possible, for all sorts of events, NFL, bands, all sorts. So is it commercially worth it to hold such events?
It certainly is. What will have happened with regards to the Joshua Usyk fight is that Spurs will have effectively, as it says here, they'll have said, we will give you a rental fee. Now, they can't just pluck a number out of thin air, because they know that if they try to charge too much, then, you know, Barry Hearn will go to, or whoever it is, will go to go to Arsenal or go to Wembley and try to get it cheaper. The promoters of the fight, they want as many people there as possible. But they will not be held to ransom. When Spurs were getting planning permission for the new stadium, part of the planning permission will have limited the number of events which could take place on non-match days. So they'll say, well, you can spend, you know, in terms of Premier League, Champions League, the two cups, we accept that. The local council will go, plus we will give you a maximum of, you know, 5, 8, 10 days, because there's considerations for local residents. There's, you know, the whilst the football club is responsible for security on the land that it owns, once you go outside of the premises of the football club, it then falls upon the local police force. So, you know, there's all of these considerations. But the way that it tends to work is that they will say, well, yeah, we will charge, you know, $600,000-$700,000, whatever it's going to be, to host the fight. We will then charge the promoter for every merchandise stall. So they won't necessarily take a share of the cut, but say, well, if you want 3 merchandise stalls, it's $10,000 rental per stall.
Right.
And the third issue is catering. Now, I think where Spurs are quite clever with regards to this is that they will say to the promoters, you get 100% of the profits from the merchandise, we get 100% of the profits from the catering. And what they tend to do, and this is based from what I hear from my neighbour Paul, who's a big Spurs fan, is that for the NFL matches and so on, they absolutely price up I think you won't get much change out of a tenner for a pint for an NFL match at Spurs Stadium. So it becomes very lucrative. And Spurs are I know that Spurs are estimated to make $800,000 per match for a Premier League game from catering alone, which is an incredible achievement. Yeah, that's more than the gate receipts that I'd say at least probably close on half of the clubs in the Premier League receive from a full season. On a match by match basis.
Now, our penultimate question comes from Jack Bird. I probably quite like Jack Bird as well, if I met him. I probably like most of the people who send questions in, to be honest, Kieran. I'm a likeable sort of chap. Jack Bird says, I think I know the answer to this question, Kieran, but I'll let you answer it. If a football player is found guilty of an offence that results in their imprisonment and means they can't play for the club, do the club have any recourse to reclaim the value of their player back from the player themselves, or is it simply a case of firing them for gross misconduct and having no more interaction with the player?
This will depend upon how long is the offence. The nature of the offence, I think, will be called into play. Most contracts will have some form of good conduct clause, an expectation by the club that the player will A, put the hours in training. We had this discussion last week about one of the Barcelona players.
Yeah.
And B, conducting himself in a way which does not bring harm to the club's reputation. So in terms of precedence, we go to the case of Adrian Mutu, who signed for Chelsea shortly after Roman Abramovich joined the club. And then he tested positive for cocaine. He was sacked and he went off to play for other clubs, but Chelsea sued him for the transfer fee and they successfully won this case and he had to pay them 17 million euro. It took about 5 years for the case to work its way through various football courts and eventually it was resolved by the Court for Arbitration for Sport. Ironically, I think at the date he lost this case, he was also partway through a second ban. This was when he was playing for Fiorentina for taking a drug called sibutramine, which is some sort of diet pill, weight loss, which probably doesn't do a lot of good type of product. In answer to Jack's question, potentially. Now, I think also the clubs have to be pragmatic about this. I mean, Chelsea certainly took a very hard line. If you've got a player who's on a 3-year contract and he goes indoors for 3 to 6 months, having conducted some form of felony, misdemeanor, whatever it's going to be, and he comes out and he's in a position where he can still play football, then what you don't want to do is to get on his wrong side, because then you potentially could lose more money. So I think clubs will take a pragmatic stand on this. We saw Derby County sack Richard Keogh for gross misconduct, and he ironically then claimed about the club. But remember, there were two other players involved in the car accident, and both of those players were retained by Derby County on the grounds of, according to owner Mel Morris, they're much younger and we can actually sell them for a fee. So, pragmatism tends to override everything, unless I think Chelsea took a fairly hard line, because other players have been found guilty of consumption of narcotics and have been reprimanded, have been counselled and so on. It's been done on a person by person basis.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's an issue in the horse racing world, isn't it? There's a couple of jockeys a year will be banned for a certain time for taking stimulants. A lot of time it's to do with weight loss for jockeys, but some trainers will retain their services and some will not. Sibutramine, when I was a teenager, if there was a drug that was based on Sibutio, I probably would have. It does sound like
it's
ground up Sibutio players. Our final question comes from Matt Riley. And if it's the Matt Riley I'm thinking of, he's the author of a recently released book on football kits called Kit and Caboodle. If it's not, then the Matt Riley who it is baffled listening to this. The other Matt Riley's got a free plug. But it's an interesting question. And this is one of the questions that got me thinking. Matt says, I used to work for a football club in Asia, but seeing what went on behind the scenes soured my experience of watching games. Can you both still enjoy the game as much as you used to, knowing what you do about what goes on under the game's bonnet? And I did think about this for quite some time. I watch TV shows and I know that the presenter and the producer are wrong-uns, but I can still enjoy the show, or more pertinently hope that it's shit. It's the same with theatres. Like I'll go to a theatre that I've performed at, and I know that backstage it's a chaotic mess, but I'll still enjoy the show, the play. And it's the same at Palace. I know a lot of the people at Palace who manage the club on a day to day basis, and they're really nice, decent people who have the club's interest at heart. So I think the answer for me is it hasn't. If anything, it's enhanced my experience, enjoyment of football, knowing that 90% of the people involved in the game and 90% of the clubs are doing good work. I mean, it's for all that we talk about the negative aspects of football, because that's what we're asked about, I think I've learned enough about the positive aspects of what football clubs do in communities to say, if anything, the opposite is the case. I enjoy football as much, if not more, than before we started doing the pod, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it took me, I probably took me 9 hours travelling to West Brom and back yesterday. Mm. I got stuck on a train on the way back with two Reading fans who were coming back from Kidderminster.
Oh dear, really? So
but they managed to console themselves with they had 18 bottles of Corona, which they drank all 18 bottles on the journey back from Birmingham Moor Street to Marylebone. And
that's not a long. That's only an hour and 20 minutes. That's a good going. I would occasionally have half a bottle of wine on that train, but that's hats off to them.
And I had a fantastic day out. As you said, in many respects, I've never been prouder to be a football fan because of the work done by the vast majority of people. And even though there are some clubs. I talk about clubs that I don't ask, but now when people think I've got a grudge against Derby County, that's absolute bollocks.
No, of course.
I don't like Mel Morris because I don't like what he's done to Derby County. So when people say to me, you're picking on Derby," now I'm picking on Mel Morris because when you've financially mismanaged a club and you gambled with its future, then you are gambling with the hopes and fears and joys of 30,000 people on a regular basis. So. Individuals in the industry I dislike because I don't think that they are football people. I don't think they're in it for the right reasons. But I still enjoy the game and, I still take the view that me falling in love with football at the age of, 7, 8, and that's partly down to my Uncle Terry and my Uncle Tony and so on, that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Mm.
I quite agree. But thank you for the question, and thank you for all your questions today. They've been very good. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, then that's very kind of you, and you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell, but I suspect it'll be a short one because he has a dirty dog to deal with.
Yes. During the course of the show, the Baroness has gone out for a run, and we have a very talented Finley in the sense that he can open doors. And she didn't lock the kitchen door when she went out for a run. And all of a sudden, I heard this commotion. He went shooting out the back of the house because he'd seen a squirrel. He then chased the squirrel around the garden for 2 or 3 minutes. And the weather has been very, very wet. And then he came back into the house. And it's fair to say that his paws were filthy. And whilst I was at I spent all day at West Brom yesterday, and I don't want to be reinforcing any forms of gender stereotypes. The Baroness is a wonderful woman in 1,001 different ways, but she likes it when I'm away because she likes to have a major spring clean. So she mm-hmm. spring cleaned the house from top to toe yesterday, and it was truly sparkling when I came home. Even I noticed it, and I'm a bloke and I don't notice these things. But I think it's now covered in mud because he came in very proud of himself and he then decided to run around the house with his pet llama called Adam. his squeaky llama called at him, and he wanted me to chase him, and that was just causing more havoc.
That was a squeal. Please don't tell me it's Adam the llama, is it?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Jesus. Oh, so Sussex. I'm minded to ask producer Guy to keep it in, but it lasted too long. Just suddenly, I laughed for the whole 5 minutes. Just mid-question, Kieran just suddenly went, oh, fuck. And then I just had 4 or 5 minutes of sound effects. Kieran chasing a squeak around the house, going, you little fuck. It was very funny. Anyway, Kieran, you're customary farewell.
Right, well, yes, thanks for all the feedback. And you know, as we see yet another BAFTA fly out of the window due to our lack of professionalism. If you want to support the show in any way, you know, for those of you that support us via Patreon, we're very, very grateful. It does help us to keep the geeks happy who do all the hosting, all that type of stuff. But there's another way that you can support the show. If you're listening on Apple and now Spotify and other providers, if you could give us a review, if you could give us 5 stars, it helps us in the charts. For some reason, we hold our own quite well in the sports charts and the business charts. And it helps us also because we're always trying to get guests to come on to broaden our knowledge and also to sort of look at the game from a different angle. So it doesn't matter what you say in these reviews. It's the stars that count. So you could say it, you'd rather have it presented by Novak Djokovic and Champion the Wonder Horse. And it makes no difference, apparently. And I'd probably listen to that, though I'd probably hear more sense from Champion the Wonder Horse.
Yeah, he's more likely to be vaccinated as well, Champion, isn't he?
Yes.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The price of football. Price of football.